Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a great episode coming up here as we roll into getting closer to the holidays. Before we get to that, though, we've got to get on with our co-host, Sam Bradley, who is the one that lines up all these amazing topics for us, and we'll get into that right next. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. I guess you and Miss Becky and Dan and a few other folks back there on the East Coast are kind of wallowing in snow at the moment. And Dr. Joe is wallowing in COVID. Hi, Joe.
Hi, everybody. Good to have everybody on tonight.
We'll be talking about that in a bit. So, Becky, really, you guys are getting hit with snow. And there's a Cat 4 hurricane, which is now downgraded. But hello, it's December. What's up with that?
That cyclone is in the South Pacific, and their season just started.
Oh, my God, right?
Yeah, so their season runs from November 1st through April 30th, so it's pretty much right on cue, unfortunately.
So it's not going to end, is what you're saying?
Not for the South Pacific, no.
Oh, my God. So what's up with the snow on that? We got a bit, week and a half ago, and it's still on the ground, but sounds like you guys really got a dump back east.
We sure did. This storm was really quite something else. Like, this is going to be in the history books. Just the way that heavy band set up from northern New York through northern Pennsylvania. I'm tired. I've been up for a long time.
Meteorologists are taking a hit here, too.
Oh, we measured.
No, but nothing sacred.
Yeah, we measured the snow every hour through about midnight last night, because we're nerds. But it was just a really incredible storm. The highest snowfall total I've seen was 44 inches, I believe, in southern New York. Pennsylvania had 43. We had 13 here in State College. Jamie, how did you end up with this?
We had about 6 inches from what I could tell from measuring. But, I mean, there was a solid, I don't know, inch of ice in the middle of that. So we got snow, then it turned to sleet and freezing rain, and then it turned back into snow. And so that mess was on the driveway to the point that I couldn't even chip it out. I'm just like praying it's going to melt a little bit.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the worst.
Like, you need a fire starter or something to get that off of there. I don't know.
Yeah, but unfortunately caused a pretty big pileup on I-80. I think like 55 tractor trailers and 11 vehicle cars. Like, nah, it was fatal. It was not good. Last night was not a good night to be traveling pretty much anywhere from Pennsylvania into New England, or mainly Pennsylvania, New York.
Well, is this week looking any better?
Sort of. It's still a pretty active pattern. There's definitely a couple of chances between now and Christmas for snow somewhere from the Midwest to the Northeast. Where exactly that sets up, not totally certain. It's still a pretty active pattern, so don't put the snow boots away pretty much anywhere that's cold right now.
Oh, my God. So, DJ, you're in New York. Did you get a good bunch of snow there?
It definitely snowed, but, it wasn't that bad where I'm at. And, you know, it's not like I'm leaving to go anywhere anyways, so my wife and I, we had a mini snowball fight, and that was kind of it. So I think maybe 8 inches in New York City, really not that much.
That was the beauty of the storm, though. Like, we didn't have to go anywhere. Like, we're really fortunate, obviously, but it was great. Very much enjoyed it.
Yeah. Now, my wife is a teacher, and she's complaining that the days of snow days are over.
Which is tragic.
I know, huh?
Now
it's
there
like
was
every day is a snow day.
There was a superintendent somewhere, because my sister-in-law, who's a teacher, shared it that they had he declared a snow day because the first snow day of the year is such a time of joy and happiness, and so he declared a snow day, and all staff, faculty, and students, even though everything was all virtual where they are, all had off for the day. Which is kind of nice.
Well, that's pretty cool. Becky says that was Jefferson, West Virginia, right?
I think so. I think I saw that.
Well, that
made me happy, though.
Yeah, that's a very cool thing to do. So I imagine you did not get snow in Tennessee. Joe. Not that you don't have enough going on there, but.
We got very little in Tennessee. Arkansas got just a dusting over the last 48 hours or so, but it was gone pretty quickly.
Well, at least there's that. So you did, we kind of threw you in a little early. So tell people a little bit about yourself and referencing the fact that your wife is a teacher. That's kind of where we're going here, talking about drills and kids and teachers and all of that. So.
Sure. So I'm really glad to be here talking with you guys about disaster preparedness and everything that's going on. So my background is I've been EMT for just over 10 years now. That's taken me, I started in Connecticut. I've done work in Boston. I've done work in Israel. I did a bit of time as a professional school safety consultant where I went into schools and helped them, you know, prepare for the worst. And that went everything from designing disaster plans and emergency response plans to running drills, to helping them acquire the correct communication plans for their school. So I did a whole bunch of everything. And right now I'm in my final year at medical school going into emergency medicine, hopefully starting in July. So that's kind of my background. And I've been working with you, Sam. We've been doing the meta credits, continuing education classes, and just try to get my hands in a bit of everything in EMS.
Well, that's how we met, both doing material for meta credits. So I'm glad we ran into each other there. So basically, and thank you, you know, congrats on the medical school. That's awesome. I didn't realize you were that far along. So, and they need you. So hurry up, okay?
I'm trying.
Expedite that. But I'm going to take, you know, some of the comments you made in your email. I kind of want to address those one at a time, and they'll ask questions and certainly add anything you want. But one of your points was we run fire drills all the time. Somehow that doesn't freak us out anymore. People cite classrooms that use the melody of Twinkle Twinkle, I got to know what that means, as a way to teach about lockdowns. But we also had stop, drop, and roll as a childhood thing, and I certainly remember that. Obviously, this is slightly apples and oranges, but why?
Sure. So this was a post I wrote a while ago in response to an article that was talking about how scary and inappropriate it was to be doing active shooter drills in schools and how scary it was that this is unfortunately our reality. And they were citing that elementary schools have started using nursery rhymes to teach children about how to respond to active shooter situations and other dangerous situations and just how sad that was. And there was this resistance to doing that. Like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this. We're just freaking the kids out. And my point is that this is a terrible situation. It is awful that we need to consider this, but we need to consider it and we need to handle it correctly. And if we look at the way that we do fire drills, I think in many ways, we've done it correctly. There's not a single person in America, and I imagine much of the developed world, that doesn't know how to respond appropriately during a fire. And it's calmly evacuate, leave your stuff, don't run, but, you know, don't dilly-dally either. Don't freak out. And we're so used to this. We know what it is. In fact, when the fire alarm goes off, the vast majority of the time, people are like, oh my gosh, this is so loud and annoying. And they're not shocked and they're not going, oh my gosh, there's a massive fire and, you know, God forbid people could die. A building on fire is a scary situation and it's way more common than an active shooter situation. And yet, even though the building on fire is really scary, somehow we've dealt with it. Somehow we've managed to prepare everyone for a fire without freaking them out. So we need to figure out, unfortunately, we need to figure out how to do that with active shooter situations. And not just active shooter situations. There's a lot of different situations where it could be just, you know, an unknown person on campus. It could be a swarm of angry bees. And we need to be able to prepare ourselves for these scary situations in a way that is effective but not too scary.
So, Joe, you, of course, train first responders and other folks on active shooter and everything else. What are your thoughts on this so far, relating it to schools?
Well, it's a huge challenge, right? I mean, too much of an alert puts people into a panic state and makes them fairly non-functional. Not an adequate alert means that they don't respond the way you want them to. There's an awful lot of variability in that, and it's a real challenge. And of course, we are exposed to loud and eye-catching intrusions into our consciousness all the time, to the point where we start ignoring all those. Right? Fire alarms are a great example. You know, it's a fire alarm. I'm not going to get up and go. Geez, that, you know, they test these things all the time. Who cares? And so it is a tremendous challenge to be able to alert people appropriately, calmly, yet get the reaction that you really want to elicit.
So, DJ, I'm seeing a parallel here. Are we getting so undistracted by normal fire drills and stuff we do all the time? And then on the other hand, you're trying to train kids to react to something like an active shooter, and that's scaring the crap out of them. So where do we find the middle here?
Yeah, I think these are both really tough points. And I was going to kind of get into it later, but I think it's coming up naturally, is that there's different levels of drills. And one of the big things that comes up is this a full speed drill? Is this a no warning drill? Is this a, this isn't a drill? And what's the purpose and benefit of doing that? And the article, especially that, you know, this was a few years ago now that, you know, this was really making the news, is a school did a, this is not a drill. So they went over the loudspeaker and said, this is a real thing. This is not a drill. Everyone, you know, this is real. And then it turned out to be a drill. And the more times you do that, the more times you kind of, it's the boy who cried wolf. Because exactly what happens with fire alarms, if you do a no alert fire drill, then the next time that the fire alarm goes off, people are just going to sit there and say, oh, this is just a drill. And so you really have to weigh the benefits of doing that. This is not a drill. And I can get into a bit more about what I'm talking about with the different levels of drills, but I want to just see kind of what, Joe, if you know, you agree with what I'm saying about the, you know, kind of the boy who cried wolf phenomena with drills.
There's no question you are correct. And again, that's part of the real challenge is, you know, you want people to know what to do, but if you drill them too much, they begin to ignore it because it's no longer startling and, you know, attention grabbing. And so it is a tremendously difficult challenge to balance between those two. So I'm anxious to hear sort of your approach to that.
Absolutely. Why don't you go ahead with that, Yadidia, since we're on the topic?
Yeah, so even before getting there, I think that the first step in this conversation really just in planning any kind of drill is you need to talk about what are the benefits of doing drills. And this is the same speech I would give when going into schools. When my synagogue was starting their emergency preparedness, the same thing I was talking about, there's a lot of benefits to running drills. And, you know, why are we doing drills? Because there are benefits. You can find out structural challenges. For instance, during an evacuation drill, we found out that the main evacuation route that we wanted could not accommodate a wheelchair, wasn't wide enough. And so we found that out on, it wasn't even a full drill. It was just like, okay, everyone, we're just going to pretend and everyone exit this way. And we found out that there are structural challenges there. You can expose communication problems. You know, if you test your communication strategy, whether that is emergency notification text, walkie-talkies, loudspeaker, whatever it is, I've done drills where I found out that, like, oh, hey, if a classroom is on the playground, they're not able to hear the announcements. And that's a major issue. And we were able to figure that out in a drill. The other purposes of drills beyond uncovering problems that you didn't even think about is practicing. And it sucks that we have to practice, but we do. One of the things that we need to, the reasons we need to practice is you never want to do something for the first time during a real emergency. So you want to practice it first. You want to actually like walk through and do things. And one of the main reasons for that is when people are stressed, they don't think. They revert to muscle memory and habit. If you have never done a lockdown drill, if you've never done a shelter-in-place drill, if you've never done a fire drill, when something happens, you're going to panic and you're not going to think. You're just going to rely on memory. And that's why there's a large number of times during these kind of situations, we find that people in panic pull the fire alarm, which is awful. And that was a big problem in Columbine, that people pull the fire alarm because they just thought, okay, it's an emergency. You pull the fire alarm. And that was wrong. So you really need to identify the benefits of running a drill. And once you identify what your goals are for running a drill, that's going to determine what type of drill you run. So I'm going to pause for a second because I think people have some questions.
Yeah, your words couldn't be truer. It's just like all the training we do in medicine. It's so when you're faced with a stressful situation, you revert to your training and you do what you know how to do, and then you could panic later. So I think there's a corollary there. But Becky, you have a question.
Yeah, so I'm curious. You mentioned that the psychological impact of doing these drills, I think particularly on kids. What is the benefit with doing discussion-based exercises versus the drills, mainly from the standpoint that they hopefully wouldn't have the same type of negative psychological impact that like an active shooter drill might? And do discussion-based exercises give some of the power and control back to the people because they feel like they're involved in talking about the threat?
Awesome, awesome question. And I love it. And, you know, when I went into schools, before we did any kind of like real simulation with people moving around with, you know, declaring a lockdown, we would always start with a tabletop simulation where we'd bring, you know, stakeholders into the room. The person who we identified that would be the incident commander, usually it's the principal, other members of the leadership team, and teachers and teacher's aides. And we would bring them in and we would do that. And we said, okay, let's talk about this. You know, imagine that you get a call from the police saying that there is a bear sighting right outside of your school. How are you going to respond? And, you know, they have to think it through. Like, okay, well, I would, you know, call over the loudspeaker. And then one of the teachers says, oh, actually, we don't hear the loudspeaker that well in our classroom. And just by sitting around and thinking of it, you identify so much and you prepare people mentally for what steps they're going to do. Are you going to get the practice of, you know, how do you move a bunch of elementary school kids who are on the playground? What is the most efficient way of getting them lined up and back into the building if there's a bear, if there's a swarm of angry bees? We always use swarm of angry bees. You know, you don't get that kind of actual practice. The more full speed you do, the more you're going to uncover hidden challenges, hidden problems. But as I just kind of talked to you through it, there's a lot you can identify just by doing a tabletop simulation. And it's a really good place to start the process of how do you get your school ready to be doing these kind of drills and ready for disaster.
Yeah, I'm thinking all those kids would run into the window looking for the bear. That may not be the best option, but, you know, that's what kids do. Jamie, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a good place to kind of start thinking about what the different levels of drills are and what are the reasons for them. I know you mentioned that there were some concrete reasons to do each of the different types of drills. So I'm looking forward to getting into that a little bit to see what applies in what situations and what are some of the reasons to do some of those things.
Sure. So once you get up to, so we always stop with the, start with a tabletop, but that's when, you know, you can move on to different levels of simulations. I've done drills where there weren't any students there, and we did it on a professional development day, and we were able to do a lot of the steps that were necessary in any kind of situation. You know, again, swarm of angry bees, and we had the teachers there, and we were able to test the communication structure, and we were able to test that everyone knew how to close and lock the doors and all those things. And then you step it up. I find that there's very little gained by doing a no warning drill, or a this is not a drill drill. When we went in and we started doing drills, we would always send out communications to everyone, everyone who worked in the building, all the students, depending on their age, all the parents. They knew that there was a drill happening. You know, it didn't really, there are very few things that you uncover by saying this is not a drill. The benefit of doing a no warning drill is that you see how people actually react when they think that they're in an emergency. And that's different than how they react when they think they're in a drill. And it's important to see that in some situations. But if you look through the list of benefits of running a drill, that's really down in the list. And there's so much you can gain without having to do that.
Becky, you made a salient point in the sidebar. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty common thing that we hear when we talk to clients in particular, and people of the public, when a tornado warning is issued. It's a very common thing that people need to see the tornado for themselves. They immediately go outside to look for the tornado, when in reality, the immediate action they should be taking is to get to shelter, because, you know, seconds, minutes can make a difference when it comes to an event like that. But there is a very deep psychological need to confirm a threat before reacting to it, I think.
Oh, that's a good point. Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think she summed it up very nicely. And that to me makes an awful lot of sense, just from the perspective of sort of matching up the right level of alertness, as well as the way you do it. So thinking back on the comments related to doing a drill with the teachers only, you know, I think for kids particularly, they look immediately to the adults in the room on what do we do now? And the actions of the adult dictate the actions of the kids. So if the adult is calm and controlled and knows what to do, that confidence is imparted to the kids, and likewise the other direction. So,
yeah, we could say that about any disaster. You know, even if you're watching it on TV, they're going to act off the parents. So if the parents are panicking, they're going to panic. If they're not, maybe the kids won't. So, Yadija, you want to run with that one?
I absolutely agree, and I think that's one of the most important benefits of running drills is to give people a sense of what to do in a situation. And I go back to my own EMT training, and I think about that a lot. Is EMTs, as you guys know, are trained for basically an all hazards approach. You know, we're not experts in any one thing, but we're experts in whatever we're called for, we'll manage. And it's because we have training that says step one, step two, step three, step four. And so even in the most hectic stress scenario, we have that training to fall back on and know how to go forward. And I think that's very similar to what we need to do when we're in schools and, you know, preparing schools, is we need to provide the tools and the training to these teachers. And, you know, we're not going to be able to run each teacher through an EMT course. We're not going to be able to run them through 150 hours of disaster preparedness. But, you know, we think about like what we can provide to these teachers so that, God forbid, something happens, we can, you know, give them the tools to at least move forward. And that's why I always advocate more of an all hazards approach rather than focusing on active shooter. Because again, active shooter, despite the media presence, is actually a very rare event. Whereas you think about all the other types of events that can happen, I'd rather do less time on just active shooter and more on all hazards approach, so that no matter what happens, the people working in school have the tools to move forward.
Yeah, I kind of like the bears and the bees better. Probably more likely to see those. But your last point was a salient one, too. In closing, drills of any type are an absolute necessity. If not done properly, they can cause serious emotional harm. Amen. We need to find a way of handling these types of drills in a way that is productive and not harmful. I think Becky would, I think that was kind of the point she's been making all the way along here.
Yeah, definitely. Mental health impacts from disasters, whether simulated or real, is a very impactful thing.
Well, and God knows, kids have been through so much this year, trying to understand COVID and having their whole school process disrupted and watching their parents panic. The last thing we need to do is throw something else on them. So, yeah, I think that's basically what you're talking about, Yadija.
I agree. And so some strategies that I would recommend for addressing this is, you know, a lot of it is going to depend on your population, how old they are, how aware they are. Elementary school kids have a combination of not being as aware and also being way more resilient than people give them credit for. Versus high school population who are acutely aware of what's going on today, and you know, might have a much more visceral reaction. So part of it comes down to what I've been talking about the entire time of, like, you know, how alarming are you with your drill? How full speed, how much notice do you give? And the article that, you know, this kind of all started with was talking about a drill where someone who was wearing, who had their face completely covered, they're completely unrecognizable, came in with a realistic looking toy gun, shot, you know, pretend shot the teacher, and then left. And there was no explanation. There was no, this is a drill. There was no, hey, we will be running a drill sometimes in the future. And in fact, there was a, this is not a drill. And so anyone in that school building had no other rational response but to panic. And I think about that kind of thing and, like, what did they gain from that? And there certainly are, again, there are some things you gain from doing a full speed and seeing how people react. But if I look at all the things I've gained from drills that are not that, I can't imagine it. So I think that, you know, you can do an active shooter drill without having someone completely unrecognizable like that. You can do an active shooter drill without, you know, bringing in that kind of stimulus of, you know, someone unrecognizable. You know, I think I made the point there. And then the last thing is you need follow up. You need a debrief for everyone there. You need to talk about and celebrate your successes, celebrate what you learned, and, you know, reassure people. And, you know, especially if you're going to do something that traumatic, you really need to be on alert for, you know, what if students take this the wrong way?
Absolutely. So, Joe, I'd have some final thoughts on all of this. You know, because your thing is very different. You're training the first responders to respond to what Yadija's talking about. So that's kind of a whole different element.
Well, I think it is a little different in that, you know, a lot of our training is focused on sort of stress inoculation for folks that are intentionally placing themselves in harm's way or in dangerous situations. as opposed to kids in schools, obviously, who wouldn't be doing that. And so it's sort of the other side of the coin a little bit, and a lot of what we work toward is getting people sort of past that initial shock of, you know, wow, things look really terrible here, and I'm sort of overwhelmed by all the terribleness, so that they can put that aside and get on to work to do the business that we do, as opposed to the other side of that we've been discussing tonight. So I really see it as two sides of the same coin in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. So, Yadija, we're winding down here. Any final thoughts you want to add? This was a really good topic, by the way.
Yeah, I think that just drills are absolutely necessary. But before you do a drill, identify your goals. And then once you've identified your goals, do it as low speed as possible while still achieving those goals. I think if people follow that advice, they'll do so great. And it's the same exact thing as if you need to, every year schools should be testing that all their fire alarms work, and they literally have to go fire alarm to fire alarm to make sure that it's making noise and flashing lights. It, you know, the goal of that drill is check the equipment. That's all they have to do. And if you keep that in mind, I think you can avoid a lot of unnecessary panic.
And make sure there's communication and that wheelchairs can get from here to there. Those are all good absolutely. Points, too. Jamie, throwing it back to you.
No, I just, you know, it's a great topic all the way around, and certainly appropriate for this show, where we're either working with the public, helping them prepare, and we talk about preparedness all the time on this, and certainly drills and those types of run-throughs of disaster are important for that preparedness segment. But then, you know, I come back around to Paragon Medical Education Group and the valuable training and education they provide to first responders. As you said, that they are running towards the danger, consciously aware of the dangerous situation before they even get moving, because they've gotten an alert, so they're able to prepare before they even get on location to a certain extent. And Joe, you know, that's something you all do is help them be prepared for what they're about to walk in the door and see.
Exactly right, Jamie. You know, again, as we were talking about earlier, it's sort of a different approach to the same issue.
So where can folks find Paragon Medical Education Group if they want to look at some of the amazing customizable resources you're able to bring together for regions and jurisdictions and organizations?
Well, we always love to talk to folks, so we can indeed customize that experience for them. We ask that they look us up on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on our Facebook page at Paragon Medical Group. And, of course, they can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. And, Becky, where can folks find you if they want to look up and see what you're up to?
Over on Twitter at WX_Bex, the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, or over on LinkedIn, Becky D. Podwin.
Excellent. Thank you. Yadija, is there any place people can look you up if they have questions about what we've been talking about or anything like that?
Sure. They can just send me an email to my address. It's ybenavie@gmail.com, and happy to talk about this. I love the sound of my own voice. I'm happy to talk about it.
Thank you so much.
If I hadn't mentioned to you before, we'd love to get you in our Facebook group, and that way we have a very large community that may have some questions, and they can shoot them to you right there.
So I am part of that Facebook group.
You are.
I
couldn't remember.
I thought so.
Very good. Yeah.
Excellent. Very good.
Excellent.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, in all those social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly the Facebook group and disasterpodcast.com. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations and certainly in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And, of course, over at DisasterPodcast.com. And don't forget, while you're over at DisasterPodcast.com on any of our Facebook episode pages, there are links right there below the player that allow you to subscribe to the show using whatever mobile device you like to use. So click the link that pertains to you, iOS, Android, even by email, and you'll get alerted when every episode comes out. So that's great, Sam. Good episode. I'm glad you were able to bring this together. It's a good topic.
Well, I've been trying to get him in here for a while, so I'm glad we did. And I'm sure we'll be talking to you again, and good luck with medical school, Yadija. Let us know when you've got that doctor moniker after your name.
Soon enough.
Soon enough. Well, Jamie, I guess, we talked about drills from different angles here, from what Joe does to what Yadija does. And I guess we can say that every drill is not the same. And maybe we'll get the schools back running so we can exercise that a bit.